Welcome to Two Ways Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Tom Wolfe was born and raised near Richmond, Virginia, where he probably developed the courtly manner of dress and behavior that marks him to this day. He attended Washington and Lee University and went on to receive a Ph.D. in American Studies at Yale. But instead of pursuing a career in academia, as his educational credentials might have suggested he'd do, Wolfe was irresistibly drawn to what he saw as the romantic life of a newspaper man. Here's how he described his vision of life in newspapers in a 1972 article for New York Magazine. Chicago, 1928, that was the general idea. Drunken reporters out on the ledge of the Daily News peeing into the Chicago River at dawn. Knights down at the saloon listening to Back of the Stockyards being sung by a baritone who was only a lonely blind bull dyke with lumps of milk glass for eyes. Knights down at the Detective Bureau. It was always nighttime in my daydreams of the newspaper life. Reporters didn't work during the day. I wanted the whole movie. Nothing left out. In 1962, Wolfe landed at the most celebrated newspaper of the time, the New York Herald Tribune, where he joined a fabled group of feature writers. Jimmy Breslin was there, so was the great sports writer Dick Schaap. And they, like Wolfe, were all honing their skills until they were ready to write the great American novel. Wolfe would get there eventually, but first he became one of the leading edge of writers who invented a style of reporting that Wolfe dubbed the new journalism. It meant writing nonfiction pieces with the flourishes and attention to mood, character, and detail that were novelistic in style. Starting in 1965, Wolfe published a number of books capturing the exciting style of new journalism. The candy-colored tangerine flake streamlined baby, the electric Kool-Aid acid test, and in 1979, the bestseller that put him firmly on the map as one of the most important writers of his day, The Right Stuff. But it wasn't enough. Wolfe was determined to prove he could write fiction. And in 1987, he more than made his point when The Bonfire of the Vanities became a literary and popular sensation. That book was set in the world of wretched excess in the New York financial community. After the great success of Bonfire, readers clamored for another novel. But Wolfe is a meticulous researcher and writer, and so it was 11 years before the next novel saw the light of day. And for that book, he looked south, to Georgia, which is where he set A Man in Full. It's the story of Charlie Croker, a colossus of the world of real estate developers in Atlanta. And it, too, is a book about the wretched excesses of wealth and the arrogance of privilege, this time set in a Southern frame. Wolfe's introduction to Georgia was facilitated by two prominent members of Georgia society, his friend Mary Rose Taylor and her developer husband Mac Taylor. They took him to their quail hunting plantation in South Georgia, and the book came to life from there. A Man in Full was published in 1998. So as we approach the 20th anniversary of the release of the book, our producer Olivia Rheingold suggested that we should talk with Wolfe about his novel. That, it turns out, was easier said than done. Wolfe is now 87 years old and gives very few interviews, but over a period of months, Olivia touched some chord in Wolfe that encouraged him to talk to me. Hello, Mr. Wolfe.
Hello. Hi, this is Tom Wolfe. Is this Bill?
Yes, Mr. Wolfe. My name is Bill Nigut. Wolfe spoke to me from his apartment on the Upper East Side of New York City. As we began, I asked him about a story I'd heard about how he developed the character of Charlie Croker. You remembered a song, I think, or someone played for you a song or sang for you a song that went something like, Uncle Bud was a man in full. He had a back like a Jersey bull.
Bull, right. I like the idea that he would be on the order of an almost mythical figure. Mm-hmm. He thought of himself as all-powerful. He thought he could do anything, including playing the real estate market in a way that had never been played before. And it seemed to be the perfect poem for a man who was determined to be a manly man in all situations. And in fact, the original name for Charlie Croker and the original name in the song was Charlie Coker.
Wow.
And I received a letter from a Mr. Charlie Coker. It was my dear sister who happened to mention to him at a party in New York that I had a main character in a novel who was called Charlie Coker. That's how he learned. He said he really wasn't very happy being identified as a kind of a buccaneer of real estate. Anyway, he wrote me a very civil letter asking me to please change the name. And so I wrote back a very civil letter stating why it would just ruin things to change the name. The next letter came from a lawyer in Columbia. And the letter said, we don't feel that the citizens of South Carolina will really look all that kindly to a book that has Charlie Coker doing the things he does in that book.
And so he became Charlie Croker.
In fact, this case was so strong, I stuck an R into the last name.
When we first meet Charlie Coker, he's down on his 29,000-acre plantation in South Georgia. And we'll talk a little bit about what you found when you found the plantations of South Georgia. But you use that poem, that song, as a way into describing him. He's on horseback, and you say, Charlie Coker flexed and fanned out the biggest muscles of his back, the latissimi dorsi in a Charlie Croker version of a peacock or a turkey preening. He seldom passed up an opportunity to remind her, talking now about his young wife, Serena, he seldom passed up an opportunity to remind Serena of what a sturdy cord, no, what a veritable cable kept him connected to the rude animal vitality of his youth. You really took advantage of that poem, that song, to describe him as you did.
For some reason, I decided to read in some Georgia folk history, and every locale in the U.S. has its own songs in the past, and I thought the idea of Uncle Mud was a man in full, he had a back like a Jersey bull, expressed exactly what I wanted to say about Charlie Croker.
Yeah.
But there was more than one colorful real estate cowboy in Atlanta, believe me. In fact, at that time, the real estate hard sloggers were so successful that they owned most of the significant plantations. I didn't realize, I always just thought of those plantations as being things were passed down from generation to generation with a great love and sense of responsibility. No, in fact, they go to whoever has the money.
Yeah. And they're maintained for quail hunting. You at one point in a conversation back when the book was published, said the first time you saw that a quail plantation in South Georgia, that 29,000-acre plantation, your thought was, this is the most conspicuous of conspicuous consumptions that I've ever seen, because they were maintained specifically so people like Charlie Croker could come down and shoot quail.
Right. Those plantations were active 13 weeks out of the year, one quarter of the year, but they had to be kept up at enormous expense for the entire year. It was very impressive. And when I was doing research for the book, I can't tell you how deeply I believe in research. It's not that you find the things that you thought were true. It's that you find things you can't believe are true. That was my experience with mating bulls.
You have a very detailed description in the book about breeding a stallion and a mare at Charlie Croker's a farm at one point. And when I say it's very explicit, it's very explicit. Did you actually watch a stallion mating with a mare?
Oh, yes. It was the fact that I was there and I saw all the things that were done to make this happen, such as binding the rear legs of the mare so that she doesn't kick the stallion's skull off his backbone. And it was not a safe operation. You're between these two animals that are either sex-crazed in the case of the male or furious in the case of the female. And this job, I hope it paid well, because they stood the imminent danger, they were in the imminent danger of being crushed by these enormous animals. That was a real eye-opener.
You know, I realize that I've kind of gotten deeper into the book at this moment, or up until now, without asking you what I think is a fairly important question. As you come up on 20 years since the publication of A Man in Full, which was an enormous bestseller, it's remarkable to me. The first printing of A Man in Full was 1.2 million copies, which it, in many ways was a tribute to what an extraordinary success you'd had with your first novel. So with all the success of that book, 20 years later, how do you reflect upon that, if you reflect upon it at all?
It seems, as the saying goes, like only yesterday. I can't believe that 20 years have gone by. And you like to feel that if a book is successful, that it's due to your genius as an artist. But in fact, so much of it depends on the material that you have. I happen to believe that each person's life is like an exclamation point sitting out in the middle of a field somewhere. So much of the terrain, so much of the environment is the society into which someone happens to grow up or develop. And I think it's a terrible blunder for any novelist not to bring out the social circumstances of the characters. And today it happens all the time. In fact, I hardly ever read contemporary novels anymore because they're purely personal odysseys. The American novel was actually built upon reporting. It was very important to people like John Dos Passos and to Hemingway to have fresh, real material that you could only get by living within the kind of society that you're dealing with. And this is just something I think writers just have to learn all over again. Right now, I'm considering writing a book, not a novel, a nonfiction piece on anarchists in America. And the anarchists are so unlike me, it has already been a problem getting close to them, but I'm determined to do it. And I think eventually one finds a way, but there's absolutely nothing that ranks even close to actually talking to the people you're writing about or about the type of people that you're writing about if it happens to be fiction.
You know, what's interesting about what you just said, though, is that you've described on any number of occasions your process when writing a novel, which is, you said once, I kind of do novels backwards. I start with locale, characters march in. So the first thing that happened with A Man in Full is, we've discussed, you've discovered the quail plantations, and that began your process of thinking, well, this might not be a bad location for a novel, right?
Well, that's exactly right. Mac and Mary Taylor, who were friends, really had nothing to do with plantations. Mac happened to have one, and I went for a visit, and I became absolutely intrigued.
So you'd had tremendous success with your first novel, which was set, of course, in New York City. It was 11 years before A Man in Full was published, and everybody was eager to see it. They really couldn't wait to read another novel from Tom Wolfe. But you are such a meticulous and careful writer that you wanted to get it right. And I think one of the most interesting stories that I've read about your writing A Man in Full is, and you can tell us the story better than I'll try to, you actually had written 800 pages of a somewhat different story about Charlie Croker that you essentially threw out and started over. Tell us that story.
If I had the time and the money for the next meal, I wouldn't let go of these things. And it also was a huge mistake to make. I had written The Bonfire of the Vanities mainly to show myself and anyone who had their doubts that I wasn't writing this nonfiction form, the new journalism, because I couldn't write fiction. I said, all right, I'll show them I can write fiction. And then I was going to go right back to nonfiction because I think nonfiction was the most significant American literature of the second half of the 20th century. But the Bonfire of the Vanities had been such a hit that it went to my head, and I ended up a very long second novel, and it was too long and took up too much time in my career. I should have done that book in 2 years. My first book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
Which, by the way, changed my life as it did many other people's.
I hope it wasn't because of what you ingested. I just don't know.
It hit me at the right moment, Mr. Wolf. I was in my 20s when that book was published, and I realized I'd been living far too narrow a life. But go ahead, please.
Well, you know, Bill Buckley encouraged his son Christopher to read the book as a warning of what could happen to you if you took these drugs. Christopher came out quite all right, however.
When A Man in Full was published, it generated enormous excitement and controversy here in Georgia. Former Atlanta Mayor Sam Massell rescinded an invitation for Wolf to speak at a luncheon of the Buckhead Coalition because the novel touched on themes of racial divisiveness in Atlanta. And the city's mayor at the time of publication, Bill Campbell, released a statement praising Atlanta's racial harmony in contrast to one of the storylines in the book. On the other hand, more than 1,000 people stood in line for up to 9 hours to meet Wolf when he appeared at a book signing at Borders Bookstore in Buckhead. The biggest game in town back then was guessing about which real-life Atlanta developer Wolf used as the role model for Charlie Croker. Everybody had an idea, but as you've already heard, Wolf drew from a number of business leaders to create Croker. If you're just joining us, my guest on Two-Way Street is the celebrated American writer Tom Wolfe. He burst on the scene with his nonfiction books, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which told the story of LSD evangelist Ken Kesey and his merry pranksters, Radical Chic and Mau Mauing the Flak Catchers, which is a sharply satiric look at how Manhattan society embraced the Black Panthers, and most famous of all, The Right Stuff about the Mercury astronauts. He's also the author of 2 wildly successful novels, Bonfire of the Vanities and A Man in Full, which is set in Georgia. This year marks the 20th anniversary of the release of A Man in Full. Wolf is now 87 and rarely gives interviews these days, so we were thrilled when he agreed to join us for Two-Way Street. He talked with us from his apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. You wrote 800 pages of Charlie Croker. He was a Georgian in your first effort to write this book, but he had moved to New York, and the book was set in New York City. And you turned the pages in to your editor, and you sat down with your editor at a luncheon. What happened?
He said, well, you might as well just publish it. You know, he knew it would be published, but it was so out of scale to be writing about action in New York through the eyes of a man who is just Georgia up and down. And so it was with a heavy heart that I went back and started from the beginning.
The story I've heard you tell about that is that you said to him at that lunch, gee, I kind of wish I'd set this whole book in Atlanta. And the response from your editor was, then why don't you? Which kind of gave you a clue you ought to do that.
Thank God I did that.
I couldn't help going back to read this novel 20 years later, that when you describe Charlie Croker and you talk about developers in general, they're one-man bands. They're out there by themselves on the frontier. All they have to sell is themselves. It's hard not to read that now and think about Donald Trump and the fact that we're talking an awful lot these days about how that's what Trump was as a developer and how it's worked against him as president of the United States. Does that occur to you?
Not in so many words, but what has occurred to me from the beginning is that Trump has never held any kind of office. And even being president of his own company is a one-man band operation. He has no sense of order. Ronald Reagan was written off by the press, which is generally liberal, as a stupid oaf. But he had been governor of California. He had been a political figure in the ideological wars of the movie industry when there was much talk of communist takeover in the studios. So he had functioned as a real active politician, and Trump has not.
I apologize if I keep going back to just A Man in Full, but that book had such an enormous impact here in Atlanta and Georgia, as you well know. So I think people are going to be interested thinking about it 20 years later. I came across an article that I loved when I was researching for our conversation. Peter Applebaum, who is a wonderful feature writer for the New York Times and who comes out of Atlanta, wrote a profile of you that was published in the Times about a week before A Man in Full came out. And he has a wonderful, I want to read you the description. I would not imagine you remember this when it happened, but here's one of the paragraphs. There was a moment after the salmon with Brittany Seasalt at the pillowy corner banquette at the Carlyle Hotel, the triumphant stroll up Madison Avenue, where East Side matrons swooned like teenagers spying Leonardo DiCaprio. "Oh, Mr. Wolf," gushed one of the women of Madison Avenue as the white suit breezed by. "I have to tell you, you look even better than your picture." "You're too kind," Tom Wolfe replied, smiling like a man in full as he strolled jauntily down the avenue toward home. And I love that because it is so much a description that many of us who have followed your career think of you as the ultimate sophisticate, being very gracious to those people around you as they come up to pay you compliments.
It sounds like I think I'm royalty. But why not?
I suspect you don't think that.
No, I don't. In fact, sometimes I just simply can't believe it, believe how complimentary people are or how nice they are. But writers eat that up. I'm not kidding. It's really what it's all about. I don't think anyone starts writing with the idea that he's going to make money out of it. What he wants to make out of it is applause.
Yeah.
And probably the super sellers, I would doubt seriously that they started out with visions of millions of dollars. If you wanted millions, you'd never start out with writing. In fact, I cannot think of a single writer who's had commercial success who hasn't started off in another way. The big complaint of, oh my gosh, now I can't think of his name, the guy who wrote The Godfather.
Mario Puzo.
Yeah, yes, he had a famous quote. You know, he had written about four novels before that, and then he wrote that. It was one of the biggest commercial and publicity sensations in my lifetime, The Godfather. And he was quoted as saying, "If I'd known it was going to be that popular, I would have written it better."
Do you ever think that about your work? Do you go back and reread any of the, either the essays, the magazine pieces, the nonfiction books, the novels, and think, I could have done this better? Or are you pretty satisfied with the way your books have turned out?
No, I think I was not a mature writer until I was in my 40s. I look back and grimace at some of the material in the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, for example, and in some of my early magazine pieces. It was a process of making colossal blunders, which obviously one didn't think were blunders at the time. There's really no way, I don't think, to learn without doing it constantly. I think of it when I think of Lampedusa's book, The Leopard. Mm-hmm. He won a short story contest when he was about 18 or 19 years old. And this so went to his head, he thought that the whole world was watching. And whatever he did next had to be sensational. As a result, he didn't write anything, total writer's block, until he was well along into his 50s or 60s, and that's when he wrote The Leopard. It was taken to 12 publishers who all turned it down, and the 13th published it, but by this time, Lampedusa had died of a broken heart. I mean, I hope that there's some sort of life after life, so you can listen in on your triumphs, if any. But I'm afraid, I gather that there really isn't.
We're going to take another break right now. When we come back, more with Tom Wolfe. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. I'm talking today to Tom Wolfe, one of the most celebrated writers in American letters. His books include The Right Stuff, Bonfire of the Vanities, and the novel inspired by the high-flying lives of Atlanta real estate developers, A Man in Full, which was published almost 20 years ago in 1998. But in the 1960s, Wolfe was part of the first wave of a new generation of writers of nonfiction who adopted some of the conventions of novels to tell their true stories. Wolfe dubbed what they were doing as the new journalism, and we wanted to talk to him about that. One of the things that I'm I have to say, going back and reading the essay that you wrote in New York Magazine, The Birth of the New Journalism, one of the things that I love about it, I come out of the Chicago print journalism world a little later than I came out of it in the 60s and early 70s. And when you were a young man, you talk about Chicago 1928. That was that's what you thought about the romance of being a newspaper reporter. Drunken reporters out on the ledge of the Daily News peering into the Chicago River at dawn. Nights down at the saloon listening to the back of the stockyards being sung by a baritone. You go on. So there was a real romantic notion in your head about what it would mean to be a newspaper reporter. And of course, you became one at the New York Herald Tribune, which had a stable of great, great writers when you were there, yes?
Oh, it did. My desk was close to Red Smith, the famous sports columnist.
Yeah.
But he was so far above me in status that we didn't have many conversations. But Chicago did have a special place because of just one after another great reporter who came out of that. And the wars between the newspapers were quite fierce. When I came to New York to work on the New York Herald Tribune, there were 7 daily newspapers in New York. At that point, I'd been there for about 2 months when the Typesetters Union, in its wisdom, decided to go on strike. The strike lasted for 6 months. When it was over, there were 3 newspapers left. And I think a lot of the heart went out of journalism in New York when the competition was not that fierce. And of course, there's no place in the country where it's particularly fierce anymore.
When people lay this notion on you, when they lay the label on you, the father of new journalism, I mean, there is some truth to that. You broke out of the mold of being a more traditional newspaper man and began writing pieces on people like Junior Johnson, the stock car racer, where you began that remarkable style that we have come to love about you. You wrote a piece on Baby June Holzer that we're going to read a little excerpt from when we produce this later. So, I mean, you really did break the mold along with a few other people like Gay Talese. But what do you think when people like me say, well, here's the father of new journalism?
Well, if I get that label, I wear it proudly. I think as a literary form, it was and is incredibly important. There's less of the new journalism written now, partly because of popularity and easy access of online journalism, which really rewards only short forms.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the new journalism, I think, was the high point of literature in the second half of the 20th century. And what had been the most important literature in the first American, we're talking about America now, in the first half of the 20th century, was something not all that far from it, which is the realistic novel. Writers were just in love with the material of America. They may express hatred for the country, boredom or something, but they couldn't resist the material. It was a great age. And then what happened was, after the Second World War, so many great young writers were now going off to writing graduate programs, where they were encouraged to be more like Flaubert without really being that good. And they just began writing something that would play on the emotions, whereas it's so important, I believe, to point out the factual terrain and what you're writing about, because so much of the emotion comes out of it.
Are there writers that you recommend that we read today? Are there novelists or nonfiction writers who you admire today?
To pick one, Michael Lewis, who wrote recently The Flash Boys, based on a piece of information that he picked up accidentally, namely that most of the wagering on the stock market today is done electronically with calculations that are at the speed that the human mind cannot equal. And the decisions are made by the machine, simply comparing the price, one form of a stock and the underlying stock. You can spot the disconnections that are going to last maybe 3/4 of a second. But that's the only advantage you need to have, is 3/4, or less than that, really, of a second to make a huge profit. Hmm. That reached its zenith, I would say, in about 2012 or 2013. It's not quite as important as it was then. But Michael Lewis picked up on it right away. Even though it's a book on economics and the math of the markets, it's an extraordinarily good read. You know, he also wrote Moneyball.
Yeah, he wrote Moneyball, didn't he? Which was turned into an extremely popular movie, even if people didn't read the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, the fact was that it was popular to people who weren't sports fans. It was about sports, but that really wasn't the heart of it. The heart of it was calculations by some obscure recent graduate of Harvard.
Right.
Who came up with these formulas.
Can I ask you two last questions, if I may? Number one, Atlanta clearly is a far different city today than it was 20 years ago. Georgia's changed enormously. Has Georgia retained a place in your thinking in a special way, having spent so much time working on the book here? Or is it the past for you?
It's the past in the sense that I know, just from what sporadic reading I've done, it has changed a lot. It's very much like when I wrote The Bonfire of the Vanities, the investment companies featured these sessions in which mostly young brokers would be on their feet screaming to place wagers on the market. And that was the most salient part of that life, was the aggressive brokers on the floor.
Right.
Today, there are no aggressive brokers on the floor. The brokers are now behind 6 to 9 computer screens.
Yeah.
The decisions are being made by the computer.
Yeah.
There's no noise in these places anymore.
Yeah.
If you want to get in touch with somebody else on the floor, you do it electronically.
Tom Wolfe, it's really a privilege to get a chance to talk to you. Your books have been so important over so many years for both the nonfiction, the two novels, and I hope we continue to read Tom Wolfe for a good period of time to come. Thank you so very much.
Well, Bill, I hope you're right, and I thank you for even thinking so.
By the way, you're not wearing a cream-colored suit as we're talking right now, are you?
The combination today is cream, white, and braid. You don't really want to know all the details.
Well, no, I just wondered if you were wearing a cream-colored suit. Mr. Wolfe, thank you again so much for talking to us.
Okay, Bill. Bye.
If you're not a fan of all things Tom Wolfe, you may be wondering why I asked him about the color of the clothes he was wearing during our conversation. It's because he's famous for the white and cream-colored suits he wears most of the time. We're going to post photos of him in all his white sartorial splendor on the Two Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS so you can see for yourself. I talked to Wolfe as we approach the 20th anniversary of the publication of his novel, A Man in Full, which was inspired by his visit to a South Georgia quail plantation and by the time he spent with at least one high-powered Atlanta real estate developer. The New Georgia Encyclopedia calls the publication of A Man in Full the biggest single event in Atlanta's cultural life since the world premiere showing of Gone with the Wind in 1939. The novel's publisher, Farrar Straus Carew, was so optimistic about sales, it printed a first run of more than 1.2 million copies. One more item before we leave you today. As we told you some time ago, after a five-year hiatus, Two-Way Street's good friend Christian Bush and his longtime creative partner Jennifer Nettles have brought their multi-award-winning band Sugarland back together. They've recorded an album of new songs that will be released in June. In the meantime, Christian and Jennifer have dropped a song from that record. It's a collaboration with Taylor Swift called Babe. Within a week of its release, it had soared to the top of the Apple Music country music chart. So as we leave you today, here's Sugarland with Taylor Swift.
I'm here on the kitchen floor. You call, but I won't hear it. You said no one else. How could you do this, babe?
The senior producer of Two-Way Street is Jenny Ament. Our producer is Olivia Rheingold. Jenny and Olivia worked together to produce and edit this week's show. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for being with us today. I hope to see you next time for another Two-Way Street.
What a waste. Taking down the pictures and the plans we made. Yeah. Your face doesn't look so innocent. Your secret has its consequence, and that's on you, babe. I break down every time you call.